This presentation is a production of the Church of God International. We pray that it will effectually cause you to grow in grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ.
If I accomplish this one thing, I'll be happy, and that is to begin to introduce you and some of the very key points in understanding how to trace these peoples that we're talking about, because the subject here is the birthright promise or portion of the promise that God gave to Abraham. We've been kind of hitting and missing with the scepter portion. I'm not going to again belabor the aspect of the scepter portion other than to reference it here. For those of you who may want to understand more about that, I encourage you to review sessions 1, 2, 3, and 4. But be that as it may, the point here in all seriousness is to essentially introduce you, if for no other reason, to get you familiar with some of these names in history. Again, I referenced last week, you don't know how to trace God's church in history unless you begin to get familiar with some of the heretical names that the Catholic Church labeled them with. Bogomils, Henricans, Paulicans. Who are those people? Those are people who kept the testimonies of Jesus Christ, and key, the commandments of God, including the fourth. And that's a key tracer. You want to follow God's true church, not the one that traditionally came up out of the ruin after the first century, and that has now come to our forefront to be known the mother of all churches, the Catholic or universal church, of which she gave birth to the Protestant or Protestant movement. That traditional imagery that you have is one aspect of the great edifice that, historically speaking, we see today in prominence. But under that, in the underbelly, as that church grew and became prominent, it beat, it stamped, it tried to swat like a fly these groups that kept the Sabbath, that kept commandments of God, who wouldn't submit to the legalization of and legislative arm and strength of the Pope and the Roman Empire, and wouldn't submit, and consequently they paid. They paid great sacrifices with their lives in some of the Colosseums as fodder for entertainment. But I say that to say this: the way you become familiar with learning how to trace God's church through history is you have to become familiar with the names that the modern traditionalists and or scholars, for whatever reason, better or worse, and in most cases they're colored worse because they're viewed as heretics, but that's who you follow. Who were the Bogomils? Who were the Waldensians? Who were the Henricans? Who were the Paulicans? Who were these people? And what did history do to them? Who were the ones that were being fed to lions in the Colosseums, tarred and feathered? And so it was last week, brethren. Again, if I mentioned anything last week, you heard a lot of names. You were introduced to names like Sumerians, Sakae, Masagate. You heard names like different types of names like Qumri, Bit-Qumri, sons of Omri, king of Israel, who was an evil king of Israel, but was well known by the Assyrians, and the Assyrians didn't call them Israelites, called them Bit-Qumri. Because why? Because Omri built Samaria. He brought the northern 10 tribes really into their, what you could say, vanguard, into their apex, and established so much in the northern tribes. Therefore, the Assyrians, they respected Omri, and they called the people Bit-Qumri or Simbri. These names in history, who then upon their captivity, again, I'm not going to belabor a lot of this, those of you who are interested, you want to get sessions 1, 2, 3, and 4, but who were taken captive in primarily two major groups over four sieges that the Assyrians put upon the northern 10 tribes. One group was taken up into the eastern sector on over toward India. The other was taken up into the north, almost directly northeastern and kind of western Caspian Sea, Black Sea, and Caucasus Mountain areas, of which over a period of years, remember how the two finally, because the ones that went out east got pushed back west, due to the Medes and the Persians, who were growing and gaining power and developing into a nation and to contend with themselves, pushed those people westward. They all kind of met up above the Black Sea. They didn't know each other centuries since they been together. They kind of lost heredity and identity and connections. And guess what they started doing? Hacking one another up, fighting for space and geography. And what did they do? They pushed themselves further west. We saw all of that in session 4. Those of you who want to review some of that and the overheads that we had associated with all of those things, you can go ahead and review session 4. But it's real important, brethren, that if, as I say, for no other reason, that you get familiar with these names, and of which I hope, as you've seen previous, that secular history and archaeological artifacts prove these realities. They prove these realities. Historians substantiate the migrations of many of these people who found their homes in the southern steppes area of southern Russia, and then later on moved westward due to fights and wars and empires rising, and Babylon and so forth. And that's all historical. That's the first and primary reason, brethren, of attempting to try and cover so much in such little time. Secondly, though, also, I want to try to hammer the fact, or at least if nothing else, present enough information to all of you to begin to make you realize this is not, point two, this is not a theory. This is reality. It's all around us. It's a major reality. And when you can substantiate these things through historical facts, by virtue of archaeological ruins and so on, as we reviewed the Rock of the Behistun, the Persians and so forth, and the development of the information there that Rawlinson had interpreted in three different languages by three different cultures that all substantiate the connection to those people who were in captivity that came from Israel as POWs. It's hard to deny anything else but it being reality. And we talked even about the fact of Josephus. Remember last week I had quoted from the ancient historian Josephus, who lived after Christ, who quoted about talking about the 10 tribes alive at that time, him indicating he knew where they were. And what did he say? They were out east beyond the Euphrates. We read Eldersheim, quoting Josephus as well as himself, another Jewish historian, and James the Apostle himself, writing James 1, verse 1. He's writing to who? The scattered 12 tribes of Israel. That's who he addressed his letter to. Jesus said, I do not come. And the woman of the well, you talk about a put down. He wasn't going to heal this woman's sick. I forget now, I think it was his daughter, her daughter or so, family member. And he said, because he was sent to the 10 tribes, or not the 10, but to the tribes of Israel, to the house of Israel, he said, to the house of Israel. And when his disciples, he said, don't go. Remember, he said, don't go to the Gentiles. Go to the house of Israel. And I didn't even bring up, and I wanted to bring up this, and the first slide here, I'm going to point out something. Dan wants to light that up. But go over with me, just as a little digression, if you would, to 1 Peter for a moment. 1 Peter 5, and in verse 13, you will see here that Peter is writing. He says here to the church that is in Babylon, elected together with you, salute you, and so does Marcus, my son, indicating, and most scholars will admit, that Peter was somewhere in this area here where Babylon is, east of the Euphrates River. Here you have Israel here. This is the Mediterranean Sea. You have the Black Sea here, the Caspian Sea, and the Caucasus Mountains. This dark line here is the essentially, as pointed out, the map of Parthia, the Parthian Empire. Remember, the kings from the east came from Parthia. Parthia bordered the Roman Empire, which was essentially this way and this way during Christ's time, with Israel or Judah being right here. Israel had been long gone and dispersed up here and over here. And here now in the New Testament time, we have Peter writing a letter, first letter, to those folks in this particular area, Cappadocia and so on, of which we'll point out here in a moment, which was in essence up on the northern borders of the Roman Empire, while Paul was down here in the southern sector, going here to Italy and so forth, and here was Crete, and again the Mediterranean and Egypt and the Red Sea and so on. So what you have here is Peter, of all things, here in Babylon. Peter, writing to brethren, as Wayne had mentioned here from the audience, in verse 1, Cappadocia, Asia, and if Dan would go to the second overhead here, I will show you that essentially what Peter was doing was he was writing to these folks up in this particular area, which is essentially Cappadocia, Pontus, Bithynia, and up in this area. Paul, he was down here in Lystra, Derbe, Perga, Laodicea, Philadelphia, Thyatira, Sardis, Ephesus, Smyrna. You know all of those. And this was his area here. And maybe they overlapped a little bit in this area. But Paul was pretty much to the south. Indications from 1st and 2nd Peter. Peter was writing to these folks, concerned about them, and writing from Babylon, east of the Euphrates. And of all things, Paul, when he closed out Romans 16, and he mentions all his salutations to all the people there in Romans 16, if Peter was in Rome, book of Romans, Romans 16, Paul writing, saluting all the brethren in Rome, Romans 16, if Peter was in Rome, I'll tell you what, he really slapped them in the face because he didn't mention them. Didn't mention them. And if Peter was in Rome, you wonder why. Paul, I mean, of all things, wouldn't mention Peter? You know, listen, look at the names over there in Romans 16 as Paul goes through the salutations, thanking everybody for their hospitality and pray for this family, pray for that family. Oh, they were so good to me here and there and everywhere. But Romans 16, you'll find Peter's name is left out. The fact is there is no history, there is no record, and there is, frankly, very, very limited amount, if any at all, evidence that Peter ever went to Rome. That's not what we're told, is it? It's interesting. Interesting point and a little bit of a digression there. But I wanted to point that out again to get you familiar with the geography and, again, the names and the things that we're contending with here. At any rate, we began to see, as I mentioned last week, how these two major groups migrated, ultimately met, and then moved westward toward, essentially, the British Isles, ultimately. And as where I'm going with all of this will illustrate the fact that for the next 2,500 years or so migrated across Central and Eastern and ultimately Western Europe to become a great nation and a great company of nations, a people, as we mentioned last week, a covenant people who were prophesied to do what? To push people as a unicorn, remember? To push them and to get them going and to continue to move. And as pointed out in another prophecy, at the result of that pushing, to be sifted through many nations, interracially marrying with perhaps certain natives of those particular lands as they pushed those people out and pushed them to where they went, much like the Israelites pushing the Canaanites out. I mean, the land of Canaan originally was, that's what Israel was called, or the land of Palestine was called the land of Canaan. And there were Canaanites there. And God gave that land to Israel. And guess what? Israel came in originally and displaced the Canaanites. The Canaanites ultimately moved down around Egypt and ultimately southward and in many cases, as many scholars will tell you, into the African areas. But these that we're talking about, these particular ones we're talking about, these particular Semitic people, white Caucasian types of people who were intermarrying amongst all of these others that were there, perhaps even Canaanites and or Mongolian types, but ultimately, in many cases, retaining certain facial features and so on, moving westward to become identified in certain ways and means by their cultural markings and habits, and again, as history shows, ultimately moving westward to become, as we pointed out or tried to point out here, or are trying to point out, I should say, a great people, a people that would ultimately mature and develop into global prominence. a people that would be extremely affluent in agriculture, in military prowess. They would be blessed in mineral wealth from the land. They would have strong economic growth. They wouldn't be subjected to many of the same general distresses that are associated with Gentile nations, such as, in particular cases, famines and diseases and pestilences, different sicknesses that really devastate whole societies and whole social structures and whole tribes of people that have created, in many cases, in a lot of those areas, unstable economic growth, unstable governmental growth, unstable conditions that have, in many respects, kept some of these other areas down. And today we even call many of these areas, such as in Central Africa, Central South America, or even for that matter in Eastern Europe, in some cases that were under the communist heel, underdeveloped countries is the terminology that we use in terms of describing many of these. But instead, remember, God promised, brethren, these peoples, these particular ones, on their way to this global prominence would become strong governmentally. They would become stable. They would become nationally affluent to the point that, remember, their boundaries would overflow in bounty. They would become so abundant and affluent that their affluence would overflow their boundaries. What am I referencing? Genesis 49. You can read about the promises that were given to Joseph. In those latter days, Jacob said, this will describe the tribe of Joseph. And Joseph would become a very prominent tribe in the latter days. Genesis 49, verse 1. That whole chapter, key, in the latter days, boys, this is your profile. This is what you're going to look like in the world, in the social scene. These will be your identification marks, or as I like to call them, birthmarks. And he proceeds to describe certain things. Technological development. They would be a charitable people. They would be technologically developed both in civilian sectors as well as military. Hygienic and health care would be certainly very prominent. Because why? They would be blessed. They wouldn't have the botches of what God, in writing or in telling Moses to write, talked about the botches of Egypt, using that as a connotation to associate the fact of certain distresses that are normally associated with other cultures of the time. Those were God's words, brethren. That's what God said. These are the things that have been attributed to God's selection. And again, I caution all of us, there's nothing about superiority here. It's purely observation of God's choosing. God is God, brethren, and he's driving the driver's seat. And he is in charge of what we have here on this earth, and it is his earth, and it is his plan, and he's working it out by his choices. And so be it. Additionally, they would be advanced in certainly arts and sciences and industry, and additionally, they would be a multicultural society. If you would, turn with me to Leviticus for a moment, real quick. Leviticus chapter 19. Writing here, we read, and the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, verse 2, speak unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, and say unto them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. You shall fear every man his mother and his father, and keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God. And he proceeds now to describe things he would expect his nation to do. Over here in verse 30, I'd like to just drop down here. Verse 30, he states, you shall keep my Sabbaths, reverence my sanctuary. I am the Lord. Regard not them that have familiar spirits, neither seek after wizards to be defiled by them. I am the Lord your God. Again, advice given by God to his nation Israel that these are the things he wants them to do. Now, in addition, look at this, verse 32. You shall rise up before the hoary head and honor the face of the old man and fear your God. I am the Lord. And if a stranger sojourns with you, that is a Gentile, someone who is not of your ethnicity, someone who is of a different race or background, Israel, this is what you'll do with that stranger among you. You shall not vex him, But the stranger that dwells with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and you shall love him as yourself. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. And he proceeds then to end the chapter here. But the point being, and again it's reaffirmed in Ezekiel 47, I'm not going to turn there, the time slot there pretty much around the millennium time, but again the same message. Well, let's turn there. Ezekiel 47. Again, the time setting as we understand this is pretty much post-millennial. A lot of things have happened here. Ezekiel, this is part of a vision, and certainly a lot of instruction is going on. But my point that I wanted to substantiate here, the same message being said from the lips of Ezekiel here in verse 22, chapter 47, and it shall come to pass that you shall divide it by lot, talking about the lands, talking about the tribes going back into their places. He says here, you shall divide it by lot for an inheritance unto you, and to the strangers that sojourn among you, which shall beget children among you, and they shall be unto you as born in the country among the children of Israel. They shall have inheritance with you among the tribes of Israel. And it shall come to pass that in what tribe the stranger sojourns, there shall you give him his inheritance, says the Lord your God. And so it is, as I say here, brethren, even today, what we have and the reality here in America is that we are a dilute culture. We are a multi-ethnic culture. Sure, in the beginning, there were a couple of, and a bunch of, and a handful of white people that landed on this land. And yeah, a bunch of white guys did get together in some respects. Scottish, Irish, British. And yeah, they did put some things together, and they did put some ideas together. And yeah, they did develop what's called a constitution and embedded what they had hoped would become a very strong social culture that a whole nation could be developed around, embedded in law, hoping that that strong culture would develop into something that would be free and new, a new world order, perhaps, as far as they understood and wanted in their mind. But the fact is, brethren, there were many cultures that made this country great. Many types of ethnic groups that as the years went on contributed to the greatness of the United States of America, and of course, even for that matter, the greatness of Britain. Much of what we have today, you can trace its roots back to the inculcation of the Magna Carta. And what came down, and even if you look real close, you'll find similarities of the very theocracy of Israel, which is another subject in itself that I'm not even going to go there for right now. But the point that I want to make here, brethren, is that there were many, many ethnic groups, specifically, that has made this country great. Germans, like, for instance, Albert Einstein, whom we know, who contributed to America very, very powerfully, and many other Germans who contributed in many respects to missile guidance systems and, uniquely enough, much of military development in technological fields of warfare and so on for the United States. There were men like Thomas Edison, who has over 1,000 patents. We know him primarily for the light bulb. But he invented the first motion picture projector. He invented originally the carbon mechanism for telephone transmission. He invented the nickel ferrous iron storage battery. He was the founder of today, as we know it today, General Electric. And he contributed a lot of things. Alexander Graham Bell, the telephone, and of course, Watson, are you there? You know, I don't know why he wouldn't be there. He's the only guy available. He's the only one receiver on the end of the line. You know, is that you, Watson? Of course. Who else would it be, you know? But at any rate, the point being Alexander Graham Bell. You know, men like, of course, George Washington Carver, a black educator, one who did great research in botany, primarily focusing on the sweet potato and peanuts and soybeans as a result, creating different cosmetics and, of course, different types of paste, vinegar, starch, even shoe blackening to polish your shoes. He contributed. I have a whole list here of individuals such as Garrett Morgan, who essentially invented the gas mask and was very critical in saving the lives right here in Cleveland, Ohio, a black man, who inventing the gas mask was able to save lives in the early 1900s when they were digging the tunnel from the 5 Mile Crib to bring city water into the city of Cleveland, and they had explosions underneath the lake, of which this gas mask was instrumental in allowing that construction to go on and to go forward. Men like Elijah McCoy, who was also a black inventor, who has over 57 patents, was the son of a slave. Yeah, we had slavery. Our forefathers weren't perfect, brethren. But you know what? Neither was Judah. The very Davidic line, of Jesus Christ was born out of deceptive harlotry. Tamar, basically fooling Judah into having sexual relations with her as she played the harlot, and out of her twins were born, Perez and Zerah. It's amazing. No, our forefathers weren't perfect, brethren. What they were and what they were used to do was to provide an environment whereby God could bring to pass the ultimate promise that he owed Abraham. That's how far all this goes back. Guys like, for instance, Granville T. Woods, who his first patent regarding the steam boiler, a black man also. Gentiles, strangers among us. Strangers among us. Contributing in all areas. This is industrial. How about Louis Armstrong? We all know Louis Armstrong. And for that matter, rock and roll music, which really, if you study music, has its roots in the cotton fields and the religious spiritualists of many of those folks' culture that came out. So, yeah, you know, maybe the country was started by a particular race of people, a particular ethnic type of people, that we may say, well, to attribute some of this stuff to that ethnic group alone isn't really politically correct, because so many people contributed to these freedoms, and they did. And it certainly isn't right to attribute all of the greatness, brethren, and all of the freedoms that have been preserved for this great nation to just purely one race of people. The 99th Squadron in the Air Force was an all-black squadron, which is quite an interesting read when you read about them and all of their heroics during World War II, and what they contributed in terms of their life and their blood, which is over there also in Europe on that soil, along with a lot of other people, Poles, Slovaks, Irish, Scottish, British, Welsh. Yes, brethren, this country is a multicultural society. And yes, brethren, it was originally brought up out of woods and essentially what we call today the grip of Native Americans, but was used, that is, those guys used originally to develop a system of things to provide an environment that would proliferate and allow for the growth necessary to fulfill, and maybe some don't like to use this term, but I'm going to use it because it certainly fits very much so, brethren, the conditions to fulfill a manifest destiny. A manifest destiny of which God had promised to an ancient patriarch way back when, some 3,000 plus years ago, when he said, "You're going to become a great nation, and out of you shall be kings. And your seed shall be so multiple, it'll be like the sands of the seashore. And you're going to possess the gateways to the lands of your enemies. And you're going to be so affluent that you're going to give to nations and give to nations and give to nations. And you're going to be hated for it. You're going to be disliked for it. You're going to be envied for it." Read it there. Genesis 49. Sounds like a pretty modern description of something that is very strong to the heart of the realities that we're dealing with right now, brethren. We don't have to be ashamed. None of us do. Whether we're black, whether we're white, whether we're yellow, or whether we're red, ashamed of this country, in whatever shape it is, because we were all used, brethren, to bring to pass God's selection, God's choice, God's purpose. Let's just be thankful that He did it. Because it is amazing when you think about it, when you think about how this country, with so many different backgrounds and cultures, and so many outside influences that wanted to tear it down even from the beginning. And I'm talking about even our brother Britain, the covenant people, who wouldn't let go and were slaughtering what they considered a rebel movement on this shore represented by 13 colonies, and of which later on the Indian War occurred in 1812. I mean, then you had the Civil War, and then you had World War I, and then you had World War II, and then you had the Korean War, and then you had the Vietnam War, on and on and on, tearing, trying to squash and to keep from this promise to be fulfilled. And in spite of the adversity, with all these multicultures living amongst each other, thrown in like a big old melting pot, which is what the United States of America oftentimes is called, a big old melting pot. It is amazing, isn't it? Don't you find it amazing that it has been preserved now for almost 400 years? That's right, 400 years, because it was landed, what, Plymouth Rock, 1607. Formerly we were a nation, yeah, in 1776. But we've been around longer than 200 years. And preserved to become now, today, the greatest nation, the greatest empire, if you want to call it that, that the world has ever seen. Technological development that can take rockets unmanned, program streets, maps, and shoot so that the things go around corners and right into living room windows, into the lap of the guy sitting on his easy chair, that were launched 300, 400, 500, maybe 1,000 miles away. That's our technology. We saw a lot of that spotlighted over there in Desert Storm. No, brethren, we've got something here that certainly I would hope many of us begin to see far exceeds coincidence. When you really think about it and let it sink in. And that brings me to a question. When is a coincidence not a coincidence? Because I know this is a lot of information. And I know that if many of you who have not studied this before, you're probably going to find this somewhat foreign, somewhat almost maybe mind-boggling. And I know I'm going through a lot of this rather quickly and unfortunately don't have the time to really digress into a lot of detail for more support and substantiation. So the only thing I can do is first say this, don't believe me, believe your Bible. And secondly, as you begin to get introduced to some of the things that I'm mentioning, study them yourselves and come to your own full persuasion about them. Because, brethren, as it does, as I've said in sessions 1, 2, 3, and 4 on and off, it will help you in your reality check with God. You know why? Because as you begin to understand that you're a bigger part, or you are a part of something much bigger than you, it will validate your faith. It's almost like looking into the other dimension and literally seeing a vision. Now, don't think I've gone over the top. I haven't gone over the top. But it is like opening up the curtain and peeking through into the spiritual side and all of a sudden seeing the realities and the manifestations of something spiritual going on, of which is so awesome and magnanimous and gargantuan in size and scope that for it to happen by chance, by coincidence, five things coincidence still, sixth
think.
7, 8, 9, 10 question. When does coincidence no longer become a coincidence? That's a question you need to answer. Because many people will tell you that what I've been talking about over the last 4.5 sessions is pure coincidence. The answer to that question is simple. When the occurrence of the conditions, circumstances, and things occur so frequently that the reoccurrences are no longer coincidental. So, brethren, what I want to do right now, I want to show you some things that have been passed down to us, of which are realities. They are realities, brethren. And they do necessitate, in many respects, they almost require one, in the face of these realities, to answer these questions regarding whether or not it is coincidence, chance, accidental, unexpected, unplanned, random luck. Because what you're about to be introduced to is just very amazing. And if you've never taken the time to think about these things, well, perhaps now's the time. Because if, again, for no other reason, brethren, it will hopefully bring home to your reality and walk with God and in your relationship with Christ to realize that you are part of a grandiose plan of which God has been working from the time of the garden with Adam and Eve to bring to pass certain fulfillments of which He and the Word at some time in the history of time made a decision to multiply themselves, to basically reproduce themselves, and to bring many sons and daughters unto glory, meaning that resurrection, unto spirit life. And how to get from A to Z, the details, one of those little aspects of details is what we've been spending time on for the last 4.5 sessions of presentation, hoping to finish the fifth one here in the next few minutes. And it's those details, brethren, that as you begin, I hope to understand them, drives you to a deeper and a better appreciation for the great calling. And it is a calling of which you have been called to fulfill, that of a position, ultimately, as a ruling king and priest in the government of God that will reside on this earth. That's important. Hopefully it's important for you to believe that. And part of believing it is to see the evidence of God's activity and interaction on earth. And one of the best ways to prove God exists, here comes my mantra again, I've been saying this all through the sessions, one of the best ways, brethren, to prove God exists is to recognize fulfilled prophecy. Why? Because as you look back in history and see those things fulfilled one after another, hopefully, if you're a logical, rational human being who has faith in God, you will, as you begin to identify those fulfilled circumstances and conditions, be more fully persuaded and convinced in your faith about the realities of God. That's why fulfilled prophecy is there. That's why one-third of your Bible is prophecy. Some will argue it's only 25%. Okay, 25%. You know. But the point being, that's why it's important to understand these things. And it's certainly important for a few other reasons, which I'm not going to get into, but will later on. I don't know how many of you are aware of what heraldry is. Heraldry. Some have defined heraldry as this. It is the art and science of hereditary symbolism. With me? It is the art and science of hereditary symbolism. What am I talking about? I'm talking about flags. I'm talking about pennants. I'm talking about banners. I'm talking about mascots. You know, the Cincinnati Bengals. What do you see? A Bengal tiger. You know, United States of America. You see the stars and the stripes. Here last week, I watched for the first time The Patriot. And there's a scene in there where Mel Gibson, he runs with the flag. And, I mean, against all odds, it looks like the Continental Army's, they're being massacred, you know, by Cornwallis. And there comes Mel Gibson just running with the flag. And everybody just gets all excited again. And all up, you know, and they get the gumption and, you know, this surge of adrenaline. And guess what? They beat Cornwallis back. Because of the patriotism, you know, and you almost kind of go goose pimply, you know, and you almost kind of tears bring, because you're into the guys, the emotions, they feel like they're whipped puppies, and all of a sudden here comes Mel Gibson with the flag, and there's that banner, that standard, that people rally around. Flag falls to the ground, what do they do in war? Somebody goes up there and picks it up. Becomes a target, but he picks it up, you know. That's what heraldry is. Flags. Banners. As I say, sports teams have them, countries have them, tribes and clans and different families have them, and brethren, Israel had them too. Most scholars will agree to the fact that we had mentioned in Deuteronomy 33 and in Genesis 49 that we've been kind of going in and out of, that those are two key chapters, 49 Genesis and 33 Deuteronomy, that begin to lay down the heraldry of Israel. And we talked a lot about this as we've gone through these first four sessions about the lion, the unicorn, the fruitful bow, the arrows, the scepter, the eagle. But there are others that we haven't mentioned and of which I haven't had time. I mean, this subject is so big and so awesome and in some ways so all-encompassing that I could probably spend a lifetime, and some guys have spent lifetimes studying this stuff, of which much of this material has been taken from their efforts in many respects. But there are other items, symbols, that we haven't even talked about. The scarlet hand, the scarlet thread, man's face, a man's face, the bull, the horn, a sword, castles, snakes, clouds, fire. All of these are heraldic symbols that have been used by the tribes of Israel to identify themselves. And Israel was no different. Numbers chapter 2. God is segregating his tribes. That's what he's doing. Because in this particular case, and as he was in some respects in Israel, he was a segregationist. And he segregated his tribes. Here in chapter 2, he says here, "The Lord spoke unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, Every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard." You know what a standard is? There's a difference on a standard. A standard is a pole with two attachments, and it's a big, big flag, much like this. This could be a standard, you know, if it had some kind of symbol on it. It would be a standard. It would have some kind of a symbol on it. And he says here, standard with the ensign of their father's house far off about the tabernacle of the congregation shall they pitch it. And on the east side toward the rising sun shall the standard of the camp of Judah pitch. Over here in verse 10, the south side, remember here Judah was on the east side. On the south side, verse 10, shall be the standard camp of Reuben. Over here in verse 18, on the west side shall be the standard of the camp of Ephraim. And over in verse 25, on the north side shall be the standard of Dan. So in every section, when you walked into these areas, you would know you're among the tribe, or you would be among the brigade of Dan. And when you understand how Israel moved through the wilderness for 40 years, you will understand that they moved in four brigades, made up of three tribes per brigade. So they had one tribe as the standard bearer. So if Reuben was the standard bearer of his brigade, 3 times 4 brigades is 12 tribes. It was Reuben, it was Judah, it was Dan, and it was Ephraim of which their standards, the Jews on the east, the standard was the lion of Judah. Remember Genesis 49, the whelp. On the west was Ephraim, who was a bull. On the south was Reuben, whose face was a man. And, of course, the standard of Dan in the north was the eagle. You had the brigade walking through the wilderness for 40 years. When they camped, they made a square with Dan in the north, the Jews on the east, and Ephraim on the west and Reuben on the south. And you had their standards upright. You had the standard, or the standard of a man, the standard of a bull, the standard of a eagle, and the standard of a lion, which, by the way, happened to be the faces of the creatures that motor Jesus Christ's portable throne called cherubim. You find that unique? When God from heaven looked on earth and saw his nation Israel 40 years in that wilderness because you guys lacked faith, Joshua, you're all right, Caleb and those guys, but I'm going to kill that whole generation out before you go into that land because you didn't believe me. When he, for 40 years, looked down on that nation, he saw the four faces of the very creatures that surround his throne, cherubim, an eagle, a bull, a man, and a lion. And they don't turn. They don't have to turn because whenever they change direction, the head that they're going for, it just takes over. I mean, it's unique. Brethren, this is the God of the universe of whom we worship. And he is very continuitous. He makes sense. He is very organized. He connects one thing, two, three. I mean, he goes right down the line. Everything makes sense with this being. And as I said, most scholars will recognize the fact that these standards are correct. Now, I've got some overheads here that I want to go through. And I'm going to try to illustrate with some of these overheads things that I'm going to put up there for your consideration. I'm not asking you to believe me. I'm going to put it out here for your consideration. And I'm going to let you see it for what it's worth with knowing the little bit of introduction that we've all been exposed to regarding the nation of Israel and the symbols. Remember, the heraldry of Israel and the things of which the Bible states are items identified with his nation, Israel. Now, these are realities that we're dealing with today. These are not things out of my mind. These are not things, brethren, in any way, shape, or form that have been made up. This is what I call evidence of connection. Evidence of connection to the lost 10 tribes of Israel. Because if you don't believe that, then the question is, where did they come from? And why, of all things, are they here among these peoples and these cultures? And again, the question, when does coincidence stop being coincidence? They became ultimately a great company of nations, or were to become, and a great nation. They were to be the purveyors of God as a witness people. Purveyors, in other words, of the gospel. Bearers, they would be bearers of the Israelitish standards and banners. Slide one, here as you're looking at it, is the British coat of arms. And you will see, essentially here underneath, the British coat of arms depicts the lion, the unicorn, and of all things, something what would appear to be insignificant, and most people probably have never noticed it in the coat of arms of Britain, but David, who was associated with the instrument of the harp. These are couched lions, this is an upright lion. And, of course, the scarlet thread of Zerah, and mostly all the symbols here, ultimately, of the crown, and of which this is translated, God and my right, or birthright. The lion is crowned, because remember, though the royalty came through the tribe of Judah. And Judah was taken into captivity by the Babylonians. and for all intents and purposes, King Zedekiah's sons, including himself, were killed. For all intents and purposes, it would appear as though the Davidic line died. Thereby, would have made God a liar. Psalms 89, read it. Psalms 89. You'll review sessions 1, 2, 3, and 4. We went through that. Therefore, if God's not a liar, the Davidic line must exist and still be existing today. You'll find Jeremiah and Brock, his scribe, took of all things, as connotated in your Bible, tender twigs, which were none other than the daughters of King Zedekiah, and ended up in the British Isles. Ultimately, through the interracial marriages or intertribal marriages of Scotland to the Irish to the British, today you have the Queens of England associated with a direct line, traceable line, as I pointed out in session 4, to the tribe of Judah through the Pharez line. And the Zerah and the Pharez, you wonder about the scarlet thread. Well, you'll remember the story, and I think it's in Genesis 38. I'm pretty sure, I might be wrong on that, but I think it's Genesis 38 where Judah gets deceived into having sexual relations with Tamar, who was married to Judah's son, and in order for this, you know, she didn't have children, so the sons had to bear, and they all got killed. You can read about that story. But the point is, she deceived Judah into thinking that she was a harlot, and Judah was out, you know, he was out on the night, and he had a weak moment, and went ahead thinking he was picking up a prostitute. Here it was Tamar, of all things. Got her pregnant. She had twins. The twins were Zerah and Pharez. In the birthing process, you can read about it. Zerah's hand comes out, and the midwife quickly puts a scarlet ribbon around its hand. But then the hand gets drawn back in, and poof, out comes Pharez. And Pharez was born. Scarlet thread. Where is it? Where's the king, the crown, Christ, the scepter, the Davidic line? Coincidence? Chance? I don't see it in Brazil. I don't see it in Tokyo, Shanghai. I don't see it in Kenya or Zimbabwe. I do see it in Ethiopia. It's there. Solomon had a good time. The very sign of the Ethiopians is the lion. That's their standard. Interesting. They carry a standard of Judah and Israel. Next slide, or overhead. In this case, what we're talking about, and in summary here, as you will see, kind of puts it all in place here a little bit. Judah, talking about the kingly line, Zerah, the scarlet cord, had the cord, yeah, it was Genesis 38, Pharez, which is the Davidic line coming on down, Zedekiah's daughters. And you can see how this goes down through, and ultimately, and even over here, Zerah. Comes down here with this kingly line as well. And again, this it almost requires, brethren, it does require studying on your own. These are facts. This is not conjecture. These are provable pieces of evidence. Coincidence? Again, when does coincidence stop being coincidence? And why, I ask. Fair question. Why isn't it anywhere else? Next overhead. I thought you might find this rather interesting. Our forefathers, originally, in trying to figure out what kind of seal was going to represent the United States of America, of all things, Benjamin Franklin, and in some cases, Thomas Jefferson, way back then, although this here did not come from that time. This came from 1856 by another gentleman. But originally, the concept that Franklin and Jefferson and a few others were kind of mulling over was, of all things, the symbol of the Israelites who crossed the Red Sea, and of which the Egyptians were destroyed by the waters when God brought them back. And this was going to be the back side, this was the front side, and for all intents and purposes, look at this heading, rebellion to tyrants is obedience to God. And it's the destruction of the Israelites, you know, because again, the freedom of oppression was part and parcel, of course, to the times, or to the day and times of our early forefathers. And this was some of the original concepts and ideas that were originally discussed. However, as time went on, as you will see here in the next slide, in the next overhead, that the idea of the eagle began. And here is a drawing that was originally done in 1782. It does look like he came out of the Revolutionary War, doesn't he? He looks a little bedraggled here in this particular case. But as you can see, and as you can begin to understand here, you have the eagle beginning to take shape, and e pluribus unum already beginning to basically show up here as early as 1782, which for all intents and purposes means one nation from many people. One nation from many people. Again, I hearken back to the prophet who said, "My people will be sifted through the nations." What does that mean? Well, you can imagine what it means by virtue of reviewing sessions 1, 2, 3, and 4, and all the interracial marriages that went on for centuries, and all the movement of people, and the Persians, and the Mongolians, and certain Canaanites, and peoples that were natives to those areas back in those years of the BC areas, and how all those people came, and then the facial features and so on that were maintained to still continue to keep certain connections of ethnicity and race associated with those people and those tribes, those origins of where they came from. But here, as you begin to see how in this particular case, this heraldry is taking shape. Now, in the next slide here, it began to take its evolutionary role. And I just show you these here just to kind of illustrate to you the development of this particular banner. And here again, what you see, this is from 1825. You see again the six-pointed star, which happens to be, of course, the Star of David. You see the cloud. What guided Israel out of Egypt? You see the brightness of the sun. What was along with the cloud? Pillar of fire. You see a star, a six-pointed star. What is that star known today as? Star of David. You have 13 lines, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 13. 13 lines, 13 arrows. Arrows, Genesis 49, your arrows would be powerful and God would bless them. Agricultural blessings, the bow. And if you look real close, although this is a bad picture, there's little fruit. If you have a dollar, you can take a dollar out of your pocket, look at the dollar. You can count the little fruit on the leaves. There's 13 little, like, fruits on the leaves. And there's also 13 leaves. Now, of course, our forefathers probably had 13 colonies in mind, but isn't it unique that there were 13 tribes, a double portion to Joseph, of which Manasseh was the last? Because remember, though he was the firstborn and the older, the hands were switched, you know, of which, by the way, is the origin in some respects. Isn't it interesting that the Union Jack has a cross? And then, of course, the Christian sign of the cross in the middle, you have the Union Jack, of which is rather unique in terms of its perhaps connection to Ephraim's blessing. But here, you begin to see this particular seal taking shape. Now, if we go to the next overhead, and you begin to see a little bit here now of of what we have. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip this because the next one does the same thing. So I'm just going to skip that one and go to the next one because I want both sides of our seal. This is the United States seal here, brethren, of which many of you are familiar with, and of which you can see. And what I'll do is I'll have Dan here. That's good. We'll just take it top again. And here you'll see your little 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. We have 13 of these. We have 13 stripes. There's your Star of David, the sun behind the cloud. And then, of course, if we raise this one up, what I'd like to do is point out this is the backside of our seal that's on your dollar, and of which has some things here that, again, I want to point out. You have annuit coeptis here, which God has favored. Says or means it's Latin. It means God has favored our undertaking. Novus Ordo Seclorum, which means here a new order has begun. This is the Roman numeral, basically of 1776. Benjamin Franklin wanted the eye on the uncapped pyramid because he wanted everyone to know, for all intents and purposes, that it took more than just us to accomplish what has been accomplished here for the United States of America, representing the all-seeing eye of God. Uniquely enough, the pyramid of all things is the birthright, or the birthplace, I should say, the birthplace of Manasseh and Ephraim, who were the sons of an interracial marriage through Joseph. And of which the name Manasseh, who in prophecy carries the identity of the United States of America, in the original Hebrew means. Are you ready for this one, brother? It means forgetfulness. Coincidence? When does coincidence stop being coincidence? Amazing. I don't pretend, or portend, I should say, I don't portend to say that our forefathers knew a lot of this Israelitish connection. But you know what? God did. It's His plan. It's His choices. There are over 33 points of connection to Israel associated with the heraldry of the United States of America and Great Britain. You've only seen a few. I have no way of time going through all of them. Not to mention all of the heraldic connections associated with the Scandinavians, the Welsh, Norway, Denmark, Dansmark, even France, of whom and of which today in their heraldry all retain the evidence of connections of animals, items, and things that were particular to the families, the tribes, and the clans of Israel. When does coincidence become reality? I don't see this in Russia. I don't see this in Japan. I don't see this, brethren, in China. I don't see this on the African continent, other than perhaps in Ethiopia. I don't see this in Brazil or Peru. I don't see it in Mexico. It's amazing. It's amazing. You be the judges. It's your challenge, brethren. Because in many respects, a lot of what you're being introduced to here, and a lot of what I'm trying to share with you, hopefully, will drive home the fact that you are part of a reality by which, as we pull back this curtain to view the spirit world, a very great being, Yahweh, who allowed the Word become flesh, divest himself of all of his power, run the risk of being destroyed, to overcome a being originally named Lucifer, Lightbringer, who today is Satan, so that he, Christ, could qualify as the firstborn to make an avenue, a venue by which all human beings could be born again through the scepter promise, through the lineage of and the ethnic group of the Jews. Remember, Christ was a Jew. He wasn't Slovak. He wasn't Chinese. He wasn't Japanese. He wasn't Mexican or Spanish. Christ was a Jew, and God is calling all human beings to become, through the circumcision of heart, the faith of Christ, he's calling all human beings to become spiritual Jews. It's an amazing, amazing event. I think the reality, brethren, is quite obvious, but certainly that's something for you to decide, because this great land, what's most unnerving to me about it, is because we have been the recipients of the greatest wealth the world has ever known. And the British covenant, Brit man-ish covenant man nation, and the individuals who colonized so much of the geography to the point where Great Britain at one time in its apex was about 10 times the size of Rome, geographically as well as population-wise, became the recipients of some of the greatest, greatest wealth too. Today, they are losing it by the year. And the United States, as we continue to what you could say degenerate into or via the legislation of larger government and the legalization of more deviancy, also become weakened in our relationship with God. The unnerving aspect is that God has fulfilled his obligation by what I observe. I don't know about you, but it sure seems to fit with the Bible. And I know my opinion doesn't really matter, brethren. All I'm stating, though, is what I observe seems to rightly fulfill what God has done. He's accomplished a great nation. He's accomplished a great company of nations. And guess what? We've been weighed in the balances, and we've been found wanting. So now, where does this take us? Where do we go from here?
This production by the Church of God International is presented to help bring you closer to the saving grace which comes through the Word of God. We of the Church of God International appreciate your response, prayers, and support. If we can be of further assistance through the free material we offer, please do not hesitate to contact us by phone, letter, email, or website. You may contact us by phone at 903-939-2929, or you can write to P.O. Box 2525, Tyler, Texas, 75710, or email us at info@cgi.org, or visit our website at www.cgi.org.